Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have a variety of things as usual.
Yeah.
Starting off with somebody that we seem to be interviewing every year about this time, Chef Tim Love, who comes and describes to us all the wonderful stuff that we're going to encounter at Music City Food and Wine, the festival in Nashville.
Okay, you're going to say you're getting me wrong. I thought we were going to have a test to find out if you knew
where Music City was.
Because, in fact, I guess Detroit used to claim that, although I guess they called it Motown. It was different. But
right.
I guess Nashville's always been the capital of country music, and it certainly still is. And
did we go to the old Opry House last
year? No, we did not.
Can we do that this year?
I hate to say this, but it's, unless you go into a performance, it's really kind of boring. I mean, it's just a great big building.
Yeah, well, the festival itself is not, because they do a really nice job of it. Listen to Tim tell us what's new this year. Tim Love is going to talk to us about this annual event that's coming up again that we're all excited about, called Music City Food. Is it Food and Wine Festival or Music City Eats, Tim Love?
It's Music City Food and Wine.
Okay. I like Music City Eats but in drinks, but that's all right. Anyhow, Chef Tim Love.
Well, you're not in charge. Tim Love's in charge.
Tim Love, you told me that you now have 8 restaurants.
That's
right?
Correct.
How many do you add yearly here?
You never know. We're adding 2 this year, so.
Uh-huh.
We'll see.
You're amazing. You must have very steady nerves.
Yeah, or none left, one of the two.
But at any rate, you are, for the second year as far as I know, a spokesperson for this festival. Give us the basics of it, what, where, when, why.
Well, Music City Food and Wine coming up here in September,
Hold on a second. I believe it's the 18th and 19th.
So Music City Food and Wine is September 18th and 19th in Nashville, Tennessee, and a booming food scene and food city that Nashville is. And when we chose to have Music City Food and Wine there, it was for the pure reason of looking at all the happenings of food and wine and cocktails in Nashville and feeling like the South was needing a premier food and wine event. So that's why we put it together. This year it's no longer in front of the courthouse. We're moving it to Independence Park, I believe it's called, with the long, brand new park, with the Capitol right at the end of it. It's a beautiful park. And so we've done some rearranging on the way the festival lays out, which is awesome. We've got a lot more activations throughout the event from different sponsors. Patron has an amazing activation. Infinity's got an amazing activation. And then the demonstration tents are at either end, so really anchoring it with a grand taste in the center. The layout is just really tremendous this year, and the park is just absolutely stunning.
Now, you said we, Tim.
Yes, sir.
Exactly. I mean, you're a part of a we, but you're not even from Nashville. So explain what the structure's like a little bit.
Yeah, so myself and Vector Management, C3 Presents, and the Kings of Leon are the partnership in the adventure.
Got it. Okay.
And so, although I'm not from Nashville, I went to school at University of Tennessee, and I spent all my summers in Cookeville, so I'm pretty darn close.
Uh-huh.
So I got a lot of Tennessee roots, and, I love being a part of Music City Food and Wine, and the fact that getting to know a lot of my contemporaries all around the South, and I'm gathering them together in Nashville, not only to show off all the great stuff that they do, but also just selfishly that we get to hang out together. It's really, really fun.
Yeah, chefs like that.
Yeah, the guests that come really see that camaraderie, and I think that's part of what makes Nashville so special.
I'll tell you, for the startup, some of these festivals have gone on for years, Nashville really got it together last year, especially.
And it was only year two.
Yeah.
That's right. And this year, I mean, the tickets are selling 3-4 times as fast as they sold last year. I feel like people in the city are really starting to understand what Music City Food and Wine really is. And we always say that, it takes a little while to get these festival for people to understand exactly what it is. It's not just a taste around. It's truly a festival. You can come and see the chefs and see their craft and learn a few things, but most importantly, and as we do with all of our festivals, have a lot of fun.
Well, we were there last year, and we sure had a lot of fun. We made the Infinity Tent our home.
Yeah.
Because the people there were so nice. But the quality of the food preparations and the level of organization were both so high. We were amazed for a second year festival how good it was. So,
oh, well, thank you very much.
We get the opportunity to go to lots of them. This one's been in our sights for 9 months, I think, already. We're fortunate that we got a hotel room several weeks ago, because otherwise there wouldn't be one. We'd be sleeping at the YMCA or something like that.
That's right. You're sleeping in one of those Infinity cars.
Yeah.
and the interest, here's a gauge of how successful the festival is around the country. A one-way flight from Nashville back to Pittsburgh, which happens to be our home, late in the afternoon and in the evening on the Sunday after the festival is over,
mm-hmm.
$600.
Wow.
And the ordinary price is $200. And I'm guessing that the fact of the matter is that they're pretty much sold out already, so we're going to hang out till Monday, so maybe if you're around Sunday night, we can get together and hang out then.
Yeah, have a glass of wine, exactly.
Well, there's a lot going on there, and I guess a lot of chefs from other parts of the country have seen an opportunity with this flowering food scene, and have opened restaurants there. What new restaurants are open?
Well, let's see, Adele's, which opened up just before the festival last year.
Yeah, we were there. I want to see if I can get into Catbird Seat this time.
Catbird Seat, that's been around for a little while, but yeah, that's a great spot.
Yeah, but they had a new chef, an Irish guy.
Yeah, and then, of course, Husk has been around for a little bit, but it's really good.
I love Sean.
I always like Kitchen 404. I think that's one of the best dinners there are there, and it's been around for just a little bit in the Gulch.
There's one I'm going to skip this year that I got my arm twisted last year to go for a meet in three.
At Arnold's.
Oh, yeah.
No. Well, now hold on a second. If you're local to Nashville, there is a special sort of festival preview event taking place at Arnold's. Around the first of September, I think.
We just had a big gathering for all the chefs a couple weeks ago, too. And then there's all kinds of little one-off parties, which is what's great about this festival. So you get in and you just kind of start feeling around what's happening. All different chefs are hosting different things. The Peg Leg Porker always hosts a very late-night party, which is awesome. And, you just kind of feel it out. That's what's great about it. Like, you got to get in there and feel it out. That's, I think, what people, like Harvest Night is one of the most amazing nights at any food festival there is, period, with all those bands that get up there and play, and Kings of Leon starting it off, and it's just amazing, Where do you get to go see Lady Antebellum sing with the Kings of Leon? Doesn't happen very often.
No, that's wonderful. And your secret to feeling around, figuring out what's happening where?
Well, you gotta get in a couple days early and just start going around to all the different restaurants that are participating, and you just kind of ask around. That's just how it works.
Oh, okay. We'll try that.
That's right.
Well, if we need to find out what's going on, we'll just call Tim Love.
That's right, you can do that too.
He's sure to know. the tasting then, did it move to the same location as the Harvest Night?
No.
Or is it yet another different place?
It's a completely different place. I thought it was called Independence Park. I need to check on that, but it's directly in front of the Capitol. You look straight down the whole park, and the Capitol's right at the end of it.
That would be impressive. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The thing that we found interesting last year, by the way, was the extent to which there's been a development of craft distilleries
See a lot of those. A lot of craft distilleries and a lot of craft beers will be showcased this year, along with all the amazing wines that we have. And quite frankly, Chateau Desclins, the the people that manufacture Whispering Angel, September 18th and 19th may be the last time you get their rosé in the United States because they just announced there's going to be a shortage. So
yeah, I
would visit their booth first. Yeah.
Why is there a shortage? It's other places as well in rosé.
Well, because people are just drinking more rosé these days in the States. And so, you know, there's only so much made. It's not like they make it every day.
Uh-huh.
They make it, they bottle it, and then next thing you know, they just hope they have enough.
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess the other place, Long Island, the Hamptons, they were running out of rosé.
That happens every year. We call that the Hamptons water.
Is that what you call it, huh?
Yeah. It's Wolfer Estate. They're rosé. That's the Hamptons water.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they're also having a breakout of Lyme's disease, so I don't know if you want to make conclusions out of that interface. But tell me this, if you were to characterize the restaurants in Nashville, especially the ones participating in this, how would it be? I mean, what kind of cooking do you expect?
Oh, wow. You got everything from, you know, Hattie B's fried chicken to something amazing from the Catbird Seed that they always bring something really inventive to some very simplistic yet really, really flavorful cooking from Candy at City House. And you got, Jonathan Waxman.
She's wonderful,
show.
Yeah.
Candy's a good
Tandy
we interviewed last year.
Yeah, Sean Brock will always show up with something. We're going to do something cool. We're doing a roasted goat crepinette with lentils and sorrel.
Oh, I want that. Pie.
And, it's just you never know.
When will you be on? I mean,
my favorite thing to do is, of course, my demo this year, which we're calling The Perfect Steak. And you definitely want to show up for that because my demo is by far one of the most fun things that I do.
Oh, it's a demo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Perfect Steak.
That's right.
Okay. So we're on for that.
Yeah.
And you're participating. There was a whole animal section last year with a goat.
That's
and
right.
A sheep.
Pat Martin. Yeah. Pat Martin will have his barbecue area again. Pat Martin and Friends, we call it. So I'll be over there with him, messing around sometimes. All the chefs kind of pop in, hang out, cook something with him. And he always hosts a great little area, yeah.
Right. Can you think of any nationally prominent new chefs who are going to be there? I thought I saw something on the website about Michael Simon.
Yeah, Michael Simon will be there. Scott Conant's going to be there.
Scott, huh?
Great.
I haven't seen him in years.
Yeah. And you can, of course, check out the website, musiccityfoodandwine.com, and it has the whole listing of the talent, which I always suggest. Andrew Zimmern's going to be there.
Oh, he's fun.
Yeah. Everybody's fun, man. We don't bring people in that aren't fun, so you can guarantee to get that.
Yeah, well, that's why we decided to come, and I think we must have established enough fun last year that decided it was all right to invite us too, because we got an early invitation this year. We had to wait last year to find out if we were able to pass muster. But this year we've known we'll be coming for a long time, and it's been a pleasure to have the opportunity to have you on and tell our audience around the world what it's all about. And listen, folks, this is a swell party.
Yeah, I'm getting excited, Tim.
Absolutely. I'm not as excited as I am. I can't wait to see you all there.
Okay.
Great. And well, thank you so much for stopping by to talk to us today, and we'll see you next in Nashville.
Sounds great. Thank you all.
Ciao, Tim. Bye.
And stay with us because we have another interesting topic to follow right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, so now Anne's going to explain how we get from Music City Food and Wine to Octopus. Go ahead.
Well, we're introducing you to my new BFF, Frank Gulo of Gulo Seafood, whose specialty is octopus. And he sent us a whole one. Now, Bill Addison, if you're listening, Bill is the restaurant critic for Eater. I understand why the probably after crisscrossing the U.S. reviewing restaurants are tired of octopus, because it's so popular right now. It's on everybody's menu. But this stuff is special, and Frank sent us a whole octopus and plus some cuttlefish already pre-tenderized, so you don't have to go out and beat it on the rocks. Let's listen to Frank talk about his seafood business.
Welcome, Frank Gulo of Gulo Seafood, who is one of my fellow Sicilians. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're a godsend for us because you have a company devoted to octopus and some other things too. But your primary seafood offering, the thing that you've created a market for almost single-handedly, is octopus.
And cuttlefish as well. Which
and
is
cuttlefish.
Yeah, correct.
Now, I guess I have two questions.
Sure.
Why?
Why?
First one is why.
Well, the reason is because we started seeing a big demand in octopus and cuttlefish many, many years ago, and I guess nobody else saw it, thank God, and I took the opportunity to start growing the business. 10 years ago when we first, you know, more than 10 years ago, but give you an example, 10 years ago we actually were starting to sell cuttlefish, and we couldn't give the stuff away. Now we can't keep it actually on our inventory whatsoever. It's always pre-ordered, and a lot of people are calling for and saying, where's the cuttlefish? So it's taken a high demand in terms of the quality and, you know, the tasting of it and all that. People enjoy
it. Why created this demand for it?
Squid was a big demand for many years.
Yes.
What happened with the squid situation is they stopped finding less and less squid. What's happening in all these big companies are buying all the squid, they're cleaning it, vacuum packing, and selling it as a frozen product. So a lot of people are now looking for something different. And our palates have become a little different throughout the years. And, you know, the average person is not looking for a squid anymore. They're looking more out of the box, and they're looking for exotic, more seafoods. And when we started seeing that so many years ago, we're like, you know what? We grew up with this product, and we're like, you know what? Why not? We can bring this to the United States and see if we can build a business on it. And that's how we actually started with the whole the Gulo Specialty Foods, by dealing with specialty seafood items.
I see. And the other thing that's really, well, there's many intriguing things about your business. You deal with Spanish product instead of Italian or Sicilian.
Correct.
Yeah, and you have a special process for tenderizing, because as I talk to you about it, the idea is you take the octopus and you beat it against the rocks to tenderize it, and you can't do that in Manhattan or
anywhere
else.
We sell probably 8,000 to 10,000 pounds a day of octopus. I think by beating one by one, I think we'll be there for days at a time. So what we do is we have these actually specialized tenderization machines. They're huge stainless steel barrels, and what we do is we put them all in there. We actually tenderize with sea salt, ice, and water, which is a formula, and each size is tenderized different times. It ranges from an hour and a half all the way up to 3 hours, depending on the size. So what it actually looks like when it goes into it, looks like a normal octopus that a lot of people, you know, accustomed to. Sloppy looking, jelly looking, and all that. But once we put it through the process, it actually turns out to come out, look like we call a flower octopus in the industry.
It
looks like a beautiful, plumpy octopus, which we call a flower octopus.
Well, it is, because, I mean, you sent us some, and very impressive.
Exactly.
The freshness was also very impressive,
because
the first time we called you as to what to do with it cooking-wise, and you recommended doing a boil with a squeeze of lemon juice. And we did that to get the flavor, and the flavor is pristine seafood.
Correct.
Yeah, and you were going to tell us why an Italian Sicilian would actually use Spanish product as opposed to any other Mediterranean source.
Well, we've actually searched for the better products. And for me, being raised in Italy, you know, in Sicily, excuse me, I can quote, put that in quotes. I'm a Sicilian born. We actually were born with a Sicilian product. But as we kept looking more into it, we came across Spanish product. And what we liked about the Spanish product is they actually have their own vessels. They strictly go out for octopus. They don't go fishing for anything else, but strictly for octopus. So once they catch it on the actual vessels, they actually just supposed to be for octopus, actually flash frozen on the vessel. And what it does, it keeps the freshness of the product. So when it comes to my facility in Hicksville, Long Island, we actually thaw it out in temperature-controlled rooms, thaw it out, it goes through the processing, and what it does is it allows you to get that flower octopus that we were discussing earlier. If it didn't take that step of being flash frozen on the actual vessel, it loses its freshness. That's the difference between products that are being caught in other areas of the industry versus being caught in the Spanish area.
Now, you said they're actually caught off the Canary Islands.
Correct.
Which is almost in Africa. I mean, it's,
correct,
it's owned by Spain, but it's almost in Africa. Now, where is the octopus? I picture it being picked off of rocks. But it's obviously not like that. Well, I picture it that way, and I have it wrong. So explain. Do they sort of swim along?
Well, they actually, well, the way they caught with long lines. And when I say long lines, and what they have, the octopus like to eat is shellfish, crab stuff, you know, everything with terms of that has a hard shell to it. So crab, lobsters, mussels, clams, or whatever it is. So what they actually do, they drop these long lines into the water. They put these, these types of meaty type of things that they like to eat, and they actually wrap themselves around the actual line itself. And when they feel there's an octopus, they actually pull it out, and they actually, that's the way they actually catch the octopus.
So it's like line-caught tuna or line-caught swordfish.
Correct. But just a lot more lines. And what they actually use as well is also buckets, tires, and stuff like that. Because octopus like to hide up in different things. So
right.
What they do is once they feel it inside of a bucket or and you know what the black ink is for, it's just to protect itself from predators. In regards to if they feel something, whatever it is trying to eat, you know, catch them or whatever it might be, they actually could octopuses and disappear.
You gave us cooking instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I like it, and if you're spending a lot of time in Spain, especially in the north of Spain, they do it superbly. They grill, I mean, pretty good size octopuses as
mm-hmm.
well. Preferred method of eating it is, or cooking is how?
My preference, like when we spoke earlier in regards to when we sent you our product, the way to try it is the best way to get a better understanding of our product is to actually just boil it. So you get the better taste out of it. You get the actual ocean taste, that sea salt, ice, and water. You get that water salt out of it, it's a much better flavor. If you grill it, it's great as well, but you're adding more flavors to it, which is fine.
Uh-huh.
But to get a better understanding of our product, to get the taste out of it, we like to personally just to boil it, so you get that ocean taste to it as well.
Well, it's funny. I took the whole thing, like you said,
mm-hmm.
and I boiled it for 10 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then I left it in the hot water on the cooking range for 20 minutes again, and I served part of it that way, as you suggested, and then I had like a little over half an octopus left,
mm-hmm.
and I also had the cuttlefish that you sent, and I thought, well, let's do a Spanish flavor. So so I did it with potatoes and onions and garlic.
Nice.
I used pimenton. I used Spanish pimenton.
Very nice.
And it turned out really good.
It was good, yeah.
It was really
good.
Excellent. And
for lunch the next day.
Yeah, you lost some of the octopus flavor, but you brought into it a whole lot of other flavor, and the Spanish love their potatoes cooked that way anyway.
Exactly. What's the difference between our octopus and the other octopuses out there? There's three things. It's the yield, which is really important. Usually a lot of people know as octopus, let's just give you an example, a 5-pound octopus, you cook it, takes 2 to 3 hours. Some people cook it shorter, a little shorter. Some people cook it a little longer. They think they're actually tenderizing and making it more tender by cooking it longer. Absolutely not. What it's actually doing is it's actually pulling the moisture out of the octopus, which is losing its flavor,
it's
and
rubbery.
It's getting smaller because you're pulling all the moisture out of it. So you're actually losing product. Our product, the reason why we tenderize is because you cook it in a third of the time versus any other octopus that's out there. What you're doing is you're keeping, you know, the size of it pretty close to what it actually was when it first went into the pot, and you're keeping the flavor on it as well. And the third thing is also it's giving you the skin. It's staying intact. It's not ripping apart. It's not falling off. It's not getting jelly and all that like a lot of people are familiar with octopus. And there's a lot more rubbery octopus that people have eaten throughout the years. People still have that mentality that octopus is rubbery. It's not ours. Everybody else's product is, but not ours because of the tenderization process.
Now, Frank, most of what you sell goes to restaurants, or does most of it go?
It goes to restaurants. It goes to the distributors. It goes to broad line distributors. It goes to cruise line ships. We do a little bit of everybody.
Whole Foods. You have it in Whole Foods.
We have it in Whole Foods as well, correct.
You know how much they sell it for?
No, I don't. And I don't want to know, because maybe I have to start charging them a little more.
Well, you'd be really appalled.
It's let's put it this way. It's considerably more expensive than lobster.
Yeah, okay. All right. So you know what? I have to look at the price point now. Well, we actually sell throughout the industry here and probably throughout the nation, all the way from California to Vegas, Chicago, Florida, Atlanta, Houston, Texas, Boston. We do probably hit every point of the industry, you know, every point of the United States that we can. And we're still growing. As a company, we continue growing every single day, and we're, you know, gaining more recognition day by day. People are calling us. We actually, you know, we founded at one of our restaurants, and we love it. We're from Canada, or we're from somewhere else, and that's how more word of mouth for us is actually working. We can put a ton of advertisement out there, but the best advertisement for us has been through word of mouth through a lot of these chefs and a lot of these distributors throughout the years.
Yeah, it's funny. We interviewed a guy maybe a year and a half ago whose specialty is wild Burgundian snails.
Oh, yeah, they're wonderful.
And he actually has them cooked in France.
Nice.
They get them from all over Europe. But he said I have a mailing list of more than 10,000 chefs.
Wow. Wow.
So this is how he gets his product out there. So you better start building your mailing list. You're not close to 10,000 yet.
Well, but you now are selling people, the ordinary home cook can go on your website and order, right?
Correct. Exactly. And home foodies alone could also go on our line and come purchase it directly online. And the great thing about these days, like you just mentioned, Peter, that you're getting cooked snails as well. What we decided to do in the last couple of years is start cooking our product overseas in Spain. We're doing cooked legs, which a lot of our sushi houses are actually using it, and a lot of people at home are using it as well. You can purchase it online. It's already cooked for you. The yield is gone. The only thing you need to do is put a little olive oil, whatever, paprika, black pepper, whatever you prefer, throw it on top of the grill, ready within 5 minutes and done. You can slice it up.
Oh,
you can put
wonderful.
In a nice bed of lettuce or something like that. So we're actually trying to make it as easy for people in the public, you know, to use the product as well. So if they go to one of our restaurants, like, oh, how do you cook your product? You don't need to cook it. It's already cooked for you. Just purchase it and just cut it up. You want it inside of a salad, just defrost it because it comes in frozen. Defrost it, cut it up, put it inside of a salad, or you can throw it on top of the grill with a little olive oil.
You know, we have a restaurant, a new restaurant in town called Taco, T-A-K-O, which is a play on taco, like, T-A-C-O.
Right.
And taco, which in Japanese means octopus.
Correct.
And so one of the specialties is an octopus taco.
Well, that sounds familiar. Because the reason is because that's what we actually serve. It's a taco octopus. And what the difference between taco octopus and anybody else's stuff that's out there, taco octopus, it's steamed versus actually boiled. That's what the Japanese people actually do. That's what's called taco octopus. Mm. What they do is, the Japanese do not like the texture of a soft sponge product. They like more of a crunch to the product. So have you ever eaten sushi in terms of a slice of octopus? You get that crunch in the octopus, and it's the preference that I enjoy is because you get a better flavor out of it. You're not pulling all that moisture out of the actual octopus when you get it to more of that softness. So So the Japanese prefer that more of that crunchiness to it, which is called taco octopus, which is what we sell. Which, again, it's a sushi-grade quality octopus that we sell. Remember, we're using sea salt, ice, and water. Salt is a cold brine, which is actually a cold cooked press product, so it could actually be eaten raw as well.
Frank, now, you were amazing.
Hold on a second. One important thing we forgot to mention.
Sure.
I think you can order online at your website, of course.
Correct. At www.guloseafood.com.
But the neat thing about it is it arrives tomorrow.
Exactly, overnight.
Anywhere in the United States?
Anywhere in the United States.
Thanks to FedEx or UPS, it'll be there tomorrow, and it arrives in the morning, so by the time you're cooking it in the afternoon, it's already thawed.
Exactly. You're ready to go. So by listening to today, you could order it tonight, and you'll get it by first thing tomorrow morning.
You're amazing. I really think even if you decide to sell ants, you'd do all right.
And you might be onto something. We might have to start doing that.
That's next. You know,
now, hold on a second. Let's talk about this cuttlefish.
Sure.
Again, because I didn't cook any of the cuttlefish on day one.
Okay.
I cooked the octopus the way you suggested. And serve that, knowing that I had half an octopus left for tomorrow, and then I made the cuttlefish into little pieces like you do squid.
Right.
And it was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
How long did you cook it for?
I put it in with the octopus and the potatoes.
Okay.
So I parboiled the potatoes, and then I made the onions and the
potatoes
and the garlic,
okay,
and the paprika, and then I actually on the side in a different pan, I sautéed the cuttlefish and the octopus in paprika using some grapeseed oil, and then I brought them together.
Nice, way so perfect.
And I will be honest, I cooked it a little bit too long.
Okay. That's what I was going to say. That's the reason why I asked that question of how long you cooked it for. Because cuttlefish is similar to a squid. The longer you cook it, you're getting it harder, and when you're actually shrinking it, you're really getting no flavor out of it. You're pulling all that moisture out. Again, squid, octopus, and cuttlefish is a muscle product. It's not, there's no blood running through its system. It's all muscle. So the longer you cook in it, you're tightening up the muscles. That's all you're basically doing. So this cuttlefish that we have is actually tenderized the same exact way we do our octopus. Mm-hmm. Sea salt, ice, and water, it's a beating process, but it's not upside down beating process. It's side by side beating. It's a little different machine, but it works for what it works for. So what it does, it breaks down the muscles of the cuttlefish that allows it to be tender. Now, when you cook out cuttlefish, slack it out, meaning defrost it. There's people that don't know about thawing it out. They marinate it either olive oil and black pepper. Remember, do not put any sea salt or any salt whatsoever in seafood because you actually want to get the flavors out of it. When you cook it, it brings the juices out. When the moisture starts coming out, you get that sea salt taste out of it. So do not stir any salt. I prefer putting on the grill. 5 minutes each side, pull it, cut it up, put in a bed of lettuce or whatever you prefer, and you're ready to go.
You're just amazing.
Thank you.
We have another project for you. My favorite thing in Spain, it's very seasonal.
Espardenas.
It's espardenas. And, you know, I asked what these were over and over again, and everybody lies. They don't want you to know they're sea cucumbers.
But they're only one bit of the sea.
Yes, they're only part of the sea cucumber. Sea cucumbers, you know, are the ugliest looking things you've ever seen.
Yes.
But the espardenas, they actually, the fishermen used to save them for themselves because there was no market for them.
Right.
And then somebody, a PR firm, caught on, sort of like the Portobello mushroom story, and all of a sudden it became this very desirable thing.
Well, whoever's listening in, we already have it locked in. We know what we're doing, and people that, you know, that know about our product constantly keep coming back to us. You know, either you're a chef, you're a distributor, or you're a foodie at home. They know our products, and you're not going to get a better flavor out of it.
Now, what are people asking for next?
Yeah,
you're talking to you know, talking to chefs, right. They're always looking for something new.
Exactly.
Is there something new they're asking for that you're working on?
Well, right now, the last thing we actually just brought on was our cooked product, which is actually growing. To give you an example, last week we saw a ton of it we sold, a ton of it. And the week before, you sell a little less. So you're saying to yourself, okay, hold on a second. We're working it. Okay, you know what? It's okay. We're selling what we need to sell. We're bringing in what we're bringing in. It's all going out the door. So obviously we're doing something right. And this has only been maybe a year and a half that we actually been bringing this product in. And that's growing. So that's one of our newer items that we just brought in. We like to take our time finding the right products before we introduce it to the industry or whatever it might be. There's a lot of fish houses out there that do sell products that we sell is considered to be a commodity, but it's not what we. It's not our product.
Right.
Our product is completely different than everybody else. We have a story behind us. Our product is, our yield is ridiculous in regards to our larger octopus. You get 70 to 80% depending on what size. Our smaller ones, you're only losing 10% versus any other thing out in the industry, you're probably losing 50 to 60% on the yield. So when a lot of the restaurants say to me, why would I buy a product from you, okay, versus the octopus guy is charging me $4.95 a pound, I always tell them at the end of the day, what does it actually cost on your actual plate? Forget about what it actually looks like on the invoice. What does it cost on your actual plate? Automatically, you turn your head around and say, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about. Well, it costs me, by the time I'm done cooking and losing 50% of it, okay, so you're paying $4.95, add another $2.45 on top, it's cost me $7 and change. Correct. I said, it's actually costing you more money than you actually think it's costing you.
Uh-huh.
You need to buy 20 pounds of my product versus 30 pounds of the other person's product, and you get the same yield. And it's actually costing you less to buy my product versus the other one. So we've been educating a lot of new, you know, chefs that just don't understand it by breaking it down that way and making them understand. And they're like, wow, you're absolutely right. It makes a lot of sense. I'm making a bigger profit on your product, which a lot of everybody, at the end of the day, it's all about the profit, as everybody knows. And it's also the quality. The quality is sufficient next to none. And I've challenged many 5 Michelin star restaurants and chefs that have gotten write-ups in New York Times, yada, yada, yada. And I've done a side-by-side comparison in terms of cooking my product to theirs. Guess what? 10 out of 10 times, I actually win the battle. I should call Bobby Flay up and maybe do a side-by-side battle with him.
Oh, you could. He likes to write that, yeah, whatever it's called.
Hey, I was in Hicksville, New York, a couple of times, Frank, and I didn't know you were there. I wish I'd known.
You got to come and see me. We're actually working on new, hopefully on a new facility soon. We're growing out of our facility. Business has been great for the last several years, and you guys have seen it in the restaurants. Octopus has become such a hot item on everybody's menu. I think we've done such a great job, especially here in the New York market. Like I said, we sell to a lot of people in the California, Las Vegas. So if you see octopus out there, probably it's coming to our facility.
Well, I mean, I'm so thrilled. And now I'll go on the website and see about the cooked prepared foods. And
mm-hmm.
that's, yeah, because I trust anything you'd make at this point. So anyhow, I think, and you'd be fun to hang with too, Frank.
Yeah. but
I'm right for a sand.
He has to go meet some octopi right now.
Exactly, some octopi.
Frank, ciao, and grazie mille.
Grazie, Peter, take care. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I don't think I know how to transition from octopus to beer. Except to say that probably beer goes pretty well with octopus.
It sure
but,
does.
But
yeah.
any event, Randy Mosher just wrote absolutely the definitive book that you need to have if you're interested in home brewing, and of course it's called
Mastering Homebrew.
And
you know, this guy knows more about beer, not just even the brewing, home brewing, but the whole global industry. He's so full of information. I bet you we're going to have him back on the show frequently.
He may know more about homebrew than Frank Goulon does about octopus, although I'm not sure about
not
that.
So sure. And
anyway, you'll have a chance to judge for yourself when you listen to Randy. Randy Mosher joins us from Chicago, as he was quick to point out, Second City, USA, but an extraordinarily fertile food and drink landscape. But I'm not sure that's entirely the reason that Randy became an expert on beer. Perhaps you can explain why you chose that direction.
And maybe we should mention the name of the book we're going to be
talking
about.
Oh, okay, we can do that too.
Which is Mastering Homebrew, which gives you a little bit of the direction.
Well, I think beer is one of those things that finds you, that for a lot of people it's a fascinating subject, and it contains a lot of different aspects. So there's a scientific aspect, there's plenty of cultural aspects, there's a gastronomic aspect, there's an artistic aspect. I think for a lot of people, homebrewing and interest in beer in general it involves both parts of your brain, so the analytical part as well as the artistic part. And when I started back in the 1980s, we were looking at a landscape here in the United States that was pretty bleak. There really wasn't craft beer except for a few places on the coast. And so a friend of mine and I got a hold of Michael Jackson's book on beer, and we started looking at Belgian beer and exotic German beers and things like that and thinking, well, why can't we have those beers? And so we started brewing really in order to satisfy our curiosity and give us more variety to drink than we could buy in the stores.
So the other Michael Jackson, as we call him, he was an inspiration for you.
He was indeed. That I remember cracking open that World Guide to Beer for the first time, and it was like an electric shock at my spine because he did such a great job of bringing that beer culture to life, bringing all the history and heritage and tradition, but in a way that just made you want to get out there and try it.
And this was at a time when the beer scene was becoming more and more a single supplier, and it looked like at some point Anheuser-Busch would control the nation.
Well, exactly. And all the regional breweries were closing down. I think at the low point in the U.S., sometime around 1980, we had fewer than 70 breweries in the whole country. And right now, I think we're somewhere around the 4,000 mark.
And before Prohibition, what was the number before Prohibition?
Well, immediately before Prohibition, I think the number was somewhere around 1,200 or 1,500.
Okay.
And the 1870s, I think the high water mark was around 4,000 or so. That was with a much smaller population than today, of course.
Now you're saying 4,000, but those were 4,000 commercial breweries.
Correct.
As opposed to your target with this book, which is someone who's interested in brewing beer for themselves.
Yes.
And I didn't know that Jimmy Carter, he was responsible for permitting home brewing, basically.
That's right. After Prohibition, when they legalized the homemaking of wine, they just sort of forgot to include beer. So it was kind of this gray area. It wasn't really illegal. People were not being prosecuted for it, but people felt a little bit uncomfortable opening shops to sell ingredients for something that wasn't technically legal. So what that legalization did is sort of open the floodgates for people to start businesses, to start shops, to start clubs, things like that, to be a lot more above board with it.
Now, I asked you before we came on the air, I said, Randy, I said, how did you manage to know all this information? This book is absolutely amazing. My next question after you answer that one is, was there anything you know you left out? But let's start with how you managed to learn it all in the first place.
Well, I think, you know, writing a book is you develop your expertise over a long period of time, and then you sit down and write it. So I've started working. When we started brewing, there wasn't much literature available. A couple of funny little books, some from England, some from the U.S., and then my friend and I started going to the public library and basically chewing through some of the professional texts and putting that into usable form for homebrewers and just started building up a big library of subject matter. And that sort of led to my first book. And other work led to other books, and this was an opportunity to kind of put it all together in one big book with an equal emphasis on science as well as art and try and help people get control of the process and really use homebrewing as a method of creative expression.
Now, this is, you said this is book number 5. So
yep.
Does it really make the other books unnecessary to have, or
would you say
people should have every book you wrote?
I try never to write the same book twice.
Okay, got it.
Publishers often want you to do that, but so I have one book that's called Radical Brewing that's all about experimentation, another book on tasting beer. This book is more, it's based on my first book to some degree, but it's been out of print for quite some time, and of course this is a greatly enhanced, improved, and much, much larger work, so it really is a completely different book. So I'd say I think all of my books are useful in various ways. It depends upon what you want to know right now, or where you are in your brewing career and what you're ready for next.
What did you leave out?
Well, there is a great deal of beer history that I really, that you don't have time to get
got
to.
Got it.
So that's a subject that I'm working on for the next thing. I covered the sensory aspects and tasting of beer in another book, so I didn't really include that to a great degree, but I tried to make this very comprehensive, tried to include an international point of view, because that's something that the hobby has really gone worldwide over the last few years.
Yeah, tell us about that, because I was surprised about that, and I shouldn't have been, because as I mentioned, we've discovered a beer subculture in Lima, Peru.
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised. I'm getting emails from homebrewers in Germany who are reading my book called Radical Brewing, and they have this underground scene in Germany, because people like their pale lagers there, but they've got a bunch of crazy people brewing weird beers there now, which is really exciting. And so when we started the homebrewing movement that eventually spawned the craft beer movement back in the 80s and somewhat before, we were really looking again to Michael Jackson and his exposition of all these great beer cultures of Europe, of the Czech Republic, of Germany, of England, and of Belgium. And we use that as our model to create what is today craft beer and modern homebrewing. And what we're seeing now is that people in South America, people in Asia, people really all over the world are looking to the U.S. as the new model for how to create beers, how to create homebrewing groups, how to create commercial ventures that find a way to honor and base themselves on those European traditions, but at the same time push them further and use them as material to create new things from, and to find ways of expressing your local identity and tastes and ingredients in a beer.
Yeah, you emphasize the seasonal aspect of this, so that fits into what's going on with the world and food and drink in general.
Yes, very much so. And then when you go back just to the pre-industrial era a couple of hundred years ago, you find that beer was really quite a seasonal product, because you couldn't brew beer all year round because you didn't have refrigeration. Ingredients didn't store as well then as they did now, so when you had ingredients, you had to brew. Generally, people did not brew in the summer because it was too hot, there was too much wild bacteria and organisms in the air, it would spoil the beer. So you'd have special beers to celebrate the harvest, you'd have special beers to celebrate Easter, you'd have special beers around the holidays. And I think people really like that change of seasons. Conceptually, they like bigger beers in the winter when it's cold, they like lighter beers in the summer when it's warm and they can sit outside and drink. And I think people really look forward to, right now we're coming up on Oktoberfest beer season, and pumpkin beer season is not far behind, and that's become a huge thing in the last few years, is people buying these seasonal beers. So it's one of the larger categories, even though it's always changing.
It's interesting that we talked to someone not too long ago, I can't remember why exactly, and he said the original beer was really pretty disgusting stuff, and the main reason it was produced was because the water was undrinkable, so you had to do something with it to be able to get it down your throat.
I've always subscribed to the idea that beer, that the good beer was pretty good, and that people really had an incredible ability to work with their senses and to create products that had great characteristics. And if you, certainly if you look back at history, you'll find no end of incredible poems and songs and religious pieces, and everything is praising beer and saying how wonderful it is and how delightful it is and what a gift it is. And so I think that surely there was bad beer then as there is bad beer now. And we, of course, we have tools to make it easier to make good beer, but I think the best beer in the old days must have been pretty good. And I've brewed some old recipes, and it's quite fascinating. Sometimes you look at some of these old recipes and you think, no, this couldn't possibly taste good. And then you brew it, and you realize that these old guys knew something, and they have a different point of view maybe, and can come up with, and would put things together differently than we might think of. But when you do that, you learn something, and, you know, you kind of come face to face with people of an earlier era, and you understand themselves a little bit better.
Now, this book is really designed to get you going to be able to know everything that you really need to know to make beer for yourself. I thought it was interesting you include a blurb at the beginning from the founder of the Boston Brewing Company. I think Sam Adams Company. And he says, "Boy, I wish I'd had this book."
When I
started out,
he started as a home brewer.
Yeah, I think he started as a home brewing businessman.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was more, you know, really had an eye when he started home brewing that this might be something that he wanted to turn into a business. But he started making batches in his kitchen.
Now, Fritz Maytag may not have done that. He just had enough money and enough interest to get it started anyway.
Well, and that was a pretty beat up, rundown brewery when he bought it, and it kind of was a black hole for him.
Okay, so he
invested, and then they said, "Well, we're going to shut it down unless you want to buy it." And so he put money into it, and kind of fixed it up over time. But it was that was the one case that's quite different. But if you look at Sierra Nevada or New Belgium or many of the very well known breweries that we have today, almost all of those folks started out as home brewers
Same thing happened up in the Seattle and Portland area where there's such a hotbed of
making. The phrase is, "Hey, dude, that beer, that homebrew is really good. You should, like, sell it." and you know, what's really great is that's still happening, that we've got a lot of people getting into the business who are not really businessmen in the traditional sense. They're just people that homebrew. They're obsessed with it. They love it. They want to find a way to build their lives around it, and they'll start little, very small breweries, usually called nano breweries, that might be brewing just 50 gallons at a time or so, and that's just enough to get them in the business and maybe bootstrap themselves up to the next stage and get a real brewery. But it's just really exciting to see that people are still getting into it for all the right reasons.
But listeners, be aware that there's a toolkit here for you if you're starting out at just exactly that level. So the things you'll need to begin with, and the things you need if you're more successful in your business or your craft grows, then you'll know how to get those things too. But I thought it was interesting when we've interviewed Sam Caligoni from Dogfish Head a couple of times. And he relates the story of how he and his partner actually wrote the laws for home brewing in Delaware because there hadn't been any before. and they found themselves in front of the state assembly in the state of Delaware trying to explain what they were trying to do and work on something that would allow them to do what it was they wanted to do
when it
had been off the statute book.
Yeah, well, homebrewing is finally legal in all 50 states. I think either Alabama or Mississippi was the last state to make homebrewing legal, and that's thanks to the American Homebrewers Association and a lot of local homebrewers who really figured out how to make it work everywhere.
You know, I wanted to say that although this will get you started even on the most basic entry level, the book is constructed as such to appeal even to really experienced brewers. And you include things in here. When we say you include everything, I'm talking about how many books on beer have things about art having to do with the brewing. Your vintage labels are wonderful.
Yeah, I think I just Well, I find that people learn visually, so I always try and make sure that, the books I do have a high amount of visual content, because I think it provides a different perspective and a different way into our brains, and so we just remember things and enjoy them more richly when we have visuals to go along with the text.
Yeah, well, when you talk about both sides of the brain being engaged, I think a good illustration of that is this entire chapter about yeast and fermentation. I didn't realize there was so much to know about that. And you have both sides of the brain engaged in this book.
Yeah, and I think that's really what draws a lot of people to the hobby. I know that for art people like me, I was trained as a graphic designer and still do that. So that's kind of my thing. But I've always really been interested in science. So for me, I get to play mad scientist a little bit. For my friends who are engineers, they like the ability to kind of be an artist. And so I think it draws people to widen themselves and broaden their range of talents and interests.
Yeah, I think some of these labels are very inventive. I must.
Well, just the naming conventions of craft beers have a fascination all of their own, don't they?
Sure do. Yeah, even though it's getting harder and harder to find unique names that haven't been registered by somebody else, so it's actually kind of pushing people to make stranger and more eccentric and more random names. So it's kind of pushing us into a little bit more extreme world of names.
You know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'd like for you to explain an example of what you would consider, because there's so many things involved with your flavoring in here. What would you consider as a weird beer?
Well, one of the commercial breweries that I work for, we just brewed a beer with grasshoppers in it.
Grasshoppers?
Yeah.
Oh boy, the insects are even hitting the beer market.
Yeah, they're a pretty popular bar snack in southern Mexico called Chapulines. And they brine them, and then they roast them or deep fry them. And we brewed a beer that's a style called a goza, that is a type of a wheat beer that's brewed in northeastern Germany. And it has a little bit of salt in it. And because these grasshoppers are brined, you can't buy them without salt. So it was our way of making use of the saltiness of those grasshoppers.
What's the difference in taste between a grasshopper and a cricket?
Well, that I couldn't tell you, because we haven't done a cricket version. But the grasshoppers gave a flavor that was partly a deep, fruity aroma and partly kind of a bright, herbal flavor that's not that different from a fresh cigarette tobacco.
Yeah, well, I bet you, like Peru or any of those countries in South America where they have access to the Amazonian ants, wolves will be using those. They're very popular.
I want some of those.
You do?
That sounds really fantastic. Yeah. They sound really, really interesting. I'd love to get my hands on them.
They're bigger than what you're thinking of. Ants.
They are?
Yeah. Okay. I do some work with some breweries in Brazil, and they're starting to work with some really unique fruits and spices and barks and tree woods and things like that down there. So that's something that's really fascinating, and I've been really trying to push that into my home brewing and into the commercial ventures that I'm involved in.
Well, it's just amazing to know that after all this information that you have in your head that you put in this wonderful book, that you haven't stopped. And
oh, no.
we wonder what the entire subject will be of the next book, what it is you'll yet invent in the future in the home brewing marketplace. But we certainly know you're going to be active, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Well, Randy, this has been a delight, and truly talking to you. And it's one of those conversations I feel could go on for hours.
I often do.
Ah. There we go. Well, you must come back and bring the ghost of Michael Jackson with you, and we'll talk about other aspects of the beer culture.
I would love to.
And in the meantime, what are you going to have tonight?
What am I going to have tonight? Well, I'll probably have a wheat beer because
a wheat beer, okay.
Because it's summer, I may have one of my breweries makes a beer we call paletas, which means popsicle.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a popsicle.
Yeah, it's popsicle. So we make a series of summer beers that are relatively low alcohol with a lot of wheat in them, so they're very creamy. And this year's version is a guava with pink peppercorns, tarragon, and orange blossom
water. Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And it's just delicious. It's very dry. It's got this incredible guava fruity nose and just a hint of spice.
How do I get that?
Well, you'll have to come to Chicago.
Oh, you'll have to be, you have to become Randy's friend. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who would like to become your friend. Now, do you have a place where you communicate with the public at large? Do you have like a website or a blog?
I have a website which I'm just about to launch officially called randymosher.com.
RandyMosher.com. So that's the place to go. It's Randy, R-A-N-D-Y, of course, M-O-S-H-E-R.
Yep.
Am I right? I'm reading it upside down.
You are. You have it correct.
I have it correct. So, as I say, keep up the great work. We're delighted to have had the opportunity to talk to you. And listeners, if you're into the even the vaguest possibility that you might get into this wonderful area of homebrewing beer, this is absolutely the book you have to have. And that's all we have from On the Menu Radio for this week. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.